Hi, and welcome to another episode of Ask a Private Lender. I'm Lawrence, your host as always, and joined by Joseph, my co-host. And today we're sitting with Grant Plunkey. He's the senior underwriter and VP of mortgage origination at Shelter Lending. Grant, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for the invite. Appreciate that.
We're excited to have you join the podcast. Simply, your background, we know you've been in the industry for a long time. We feel like you can share your experiences, maybe give some people advice or an understanding as to what the market is like and what private lending is all about. The first thing I wanted to start off with is, how you got into the business. I mean, it's not a career path that people generally set out and look for, but, my understanding is that there's some people in your family who are private lenders way back when, and you saw that growing up. And did that play into you actually getting into the industry from a younger age, or was it something that you did later on?
Well, to not make a whole hour episode about that one answer, I'll try to keep it brief. But there's a little bit of both elements in there. I don't think kids grow up dreaming of being a mortgage broker. And I had dreams of doing something else. I thought that I might be a golf pro playing on television, but unfortunately I was limited by my talent. And then I also realized that seeing as that wasn't going to happen, I better stay in school. And I was actually on a path to become a lawyer. And that started appealing less and less to me after about 5 or 6 years of university. So I got into the workforce and anyhow, through a series of circumstances, ended up buying a house and getting a mortgage and met a mortgage broker. But to back up just a little bit where I sort of became aware of this, it was actually my grandfather that was the private lender. And he came to Canada as a young man back in about 1920 and really had nothing, worked hard, but he did have some pretty good smarts about real estate for some reason. And he started out basically doing agreements for sale where he was buying properties for his brother-in-laws because they weren't able to get credit or they didn't have the income to show, whereas he did. He found out that that was actually quite lucrative or could be more lucrative when you're dealing with non-family members. So he quickly aligned himself with a lawyer that somehow seemed to have a lot of these clients in Edmonton and started his private lending career and did very, very well with it. So much so that he ended up giving away a house to a charity that he was concerned about. And he also bought a fairly large farm and gifted that to my aunt and uncle. So he did very well with it. Now, the unfortunate part of that story is out of all of that wealth that he created with mortgages, I didn't get a dime. However, I did get an idea. I always thought that when I would be, older and have some investment money, that I would invest in mortgages just like my grandfather did. To short circuit that whole idea, when I got a mortgage, I dealt with a mortgage broker because the rates were far better than dealing with the bank at that time. And I ended up talking to the broker that handled my transaction quite a bit. And I wasn't happy with where I was working at. It kind of appealed to me. I thought, if I can't be the lender, I could be the middleman. And so I thought, yeah, this middleman idea appealed to me. You're not dealing with inventory, which was a problem at the business I was running, and we weren't dealing with staff in a mortgage brokerage, very limited, maybe a underwriter or secretary or support staff, but not the staffing issues that I had at that store. So anyhow, there was a lot of things that appealed to me about a mortgage brokering career at that point. And so that was the impetus for me. And that was 25 years ago that I had those conversations and 24 years ago jumped into the industry. So that's the short version. Sorry.
To go back, just because it's such a unique, thing that we hear, and we talk to a lot of private lenders, but, your grandfather doing this such a long time ago. I mean,
there's 100 years of private lending in Grant's blood.
Yeah, it's and this was like a his full business that he set out, and that, or is it something that he did on the side? Was it?
This was just on the side.
This was on the side that he was doing that. That's phenomenal. The amount of money he was probably lending at the time seemed like so much. If he could see the dollars that you're lending out, it'd probably,
it would be mind-boggling.
It would be.
When you're buying homes, for a couple thousand dollars back in the day, and somebody needs $1,000. Those were right. big dollars way back when. And for us now, that barely, that doesn't even cover the legal fees.
Right.
That's right.
I was going to say, it might pay for a mailbox on your lawn at best.
Yeah.
So you got into the business about 25 years ago. You started as a mortgage broker, from what I gather, from you were saying. Mm-hmm. So you were helping people get bank financing to start. Was that your entry into the business?
Yeah, that's correct. I did that exclusively brokering, where I didn't have a fund or didn't have access to private investors. So I was really what I call a retail broker. And I did that for about 13 years. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was very good to me. Through that process, I started more and more private deals. I don't know how they found me. They just did. I don't know if it was some sort of a vibe that I was putting out there. But anyhow, these deals just kept on coming to me, and I kept on getting them done and finding new lenders and new sources of money, to finally reaching the point where I thought, I find this kind of to be my niche in the business and want to make a career out of the private money side. And that was
very interesting.
Yeah, that was 10 years ago, or a little bit over 10 years ago, that I've exclusively been dealing in private mortgages. I haven't brokered a deal. I haven't sent a deal to a bank or a monoline since 2009.
It just seems like the natural progression. You know, a lot of people we talk to who've been in the industry for quite some time, it seems like they started, whether it was banking or brokering, and then they saw, you know, those are mainstream financial avenues that people are aware of. And then slowly through some, you know, alley or some way, you end up figuring out that there's a big opportunity in private lending. And I want to ask you, when you got into it, it probably wasn't as competitive as it is today.
It was a lot different. The landscape for brokers was far, far different. So in the community where I live, which is Kelowna, BC, there were about 20 brokers in the community when I started, and it was quite noticeable that there was a new guy. And I believe at that time I was either the youngest or the second youngest broker in the city. And now I can't even tell you how many brokers there are. There might be 200, give or take. And while it is more competitive amongst the brokers and the banks, everybody's vying for the business. 20 plus years ago, there just weren't the options for lenders or for brokers such as myself. Then it was easier to stand out as a broker, but it was harder to get deals done because the lenders just didn't exist.
That makes sense. And now you're with Shelter Lending, and you've been with them for how long?
Well, Shelter Lending is sort of a brand new entity. And what happened, it was brought about by some regulatory changes, not on the mortgage side, but more on the security side. And so, as I mentioned, I've been exclusively working in the private lending market for about 10 years. And my business partner in this, his name is Dave McKittrick. He was working in private lending since about 2005. And he left the company that he was at. It was a MIC that's over $100 million. I was the business development officer and senior underwriter for a large MIC that was about $150 million. We left our respective companies, roughly speaking, at about the same time. We were interested in working together, but I had a non-compete agreement. So that kind of kiboshed that for a couple of years. In that time period, I started my own MIC, and I was also dealing with a number of individual private investors. So we had quite a stable of investors built up around my company. And there were some changes with BC Securities in the capital raising department. So all of a sudden, we had to use an exempt market dealer or third-party fundraiser, and it became far more expensive to raise capital. And also, we were a small company. That was my company. It was just not practical to carry on. And so Dave and I talked again. He was in the process of acquiring the management contract of a MIC where the operator was retiring. And so we decided that this was a good time to join forces. My non-compete had expired. Dave was getting too busy to handle both the lending and investor side. And so he's focused exclusively now on the investor side with our exempt market dealer. So we do have an exempt market dealer that's a captive company that only raises money for our own funds. And I handle the operation side of the mortgage business.
So even though the company itself is a newer entity, you guys are running it like it's been around for 20 plus years because you've been in the business, you know the business, you've worked at those types of companies and helped run them. So what kind of deals are you guys doing? Is it mainly residential and commercial? What are you looking for out there?
Right now, it's strictly residential. As our fund grows, we may entertain some commercial loans, but for the time being, the foreseeable future, it's strictly residential.
And is that first
mortgages, second mortgages, what mm-hmm. type?
Yeah, we're doing first and seconds. We're licensed in BC and Alberta, and we're able to do business in Manitoba, although we haven't set up there yet. So just BC and Alberta for today. And we're looking primarily for second mortgages, but we also do have a first mortgage fund. The second mortgage fund, what I always tell brokers when they ask what our niche is, I say, you know, if lender XYZ is going to 65%, we'll probably go to 70. If they're going to 70, we'll probably go to 75. So that's a bit of our niche where we go just a little bit above and beyond.
Interesting.
Got it.
So you mentioned, and I've had the pleasure of speaking with both of you guys before, and I knew that Dave was out in Alberta. How do you guys compare the two markets? And do you rely on Dave to sort of give you that insight in Alberta and he really solely trusts you in BC? Or have you personally gained so much information, knowledge during your time in this industry that you are comfortable with both, I guess, Calgary, Edmonton, maybe surrounding areas and, greater Vancouver and surrounding areas?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Joseph. I've been underwriting for Western Canada for over 10 years now. And while I've gained a lot of knowledge of the communities and the industries that are in them, it's not perfect knowledge. And so we have people on the ground. And Dave's a fantastic resource when we've got a deal in Calgary because he just knows the neighborhoods. If you mention a neighborhood, he knows it. Whereas I have to look at it on the map. But what we do to keep up to date with all of the data that we need to make decisions is we have regular conversations with realtors in each market, conversations with our appraisers, and then we look at the stats that come out from CMHC and Genworth or whatever they're, Sagen, I guess they're called now. But we try to keep on top of the markets that we land in, which are primarily urban markets. So you mentioned a few different cities in Alberta, and as long as the city has greater than 5,000 people, we're probably interested in lending there. Apart from Fort Mac, we can't help you there. We just have to draw the line somewhere. And we also stay out of the greater Vancouver market for the most part. And that's strictly because the deal size is so large.
Right.
There's so many lenders there that it's so competitive.
It's almost saturated at this point.
It is. It is. And we just decided that there's enough of a market elsewhere for us, and we're going to pursue that market.
And I guess my question is, given that Alberta is more, I guess, oil dependent, right? The real estate market does fluctuate based on oil and how well it's doing. Do you guys have different loan to value criteria or risk appetite in Alberta versus BC? Or is it 70, 75 across the board, both places?
It does vary by province, and it also varies community by community. So when we're looking at a large marketable community, say, Victoria or Kelowna, for example, we're far more aggressive in those communities because we know that there's a more balanced and diverse economy. When we're looking at smaller communities where there might only be 5,000 people living in there, there's obviously a reason why there's 5,000 people there. It doesn't have the industry to support jobs, or it doesn't have the appeal. So we just basically scale back our loan to values in those communities. And in regards to Alberta right now, we are a little bit more cautious. We're in a wait and see mode. We're still doing business there. We funded a couple deals there within the past 30 days, but really probably 80% of our new business, 90% of our new business is applications coming in from BC.
Gotcha.
Very interesting. And you obviously, you deal with brokers. That's where I guess the majority of your business comes in from. For brokers who want to submit deals to you that maybe haven't done business with you before, is there a specific person they should be reaching out to or getting in touch with?
Yeah, absolutely. That's me. And I can be reached via email. grant@shelterlending.ca is my email. We've got a toll-free number on our website. And we deal exclusively with mortgage brokers. So we're not sourcing any of our own business. So we're not competing with our brokers. We just want to make sure that we're looking after them. We treat our investors as our primary clients. We treat our brokers as our primary, secondary primary clients, if you will. Absolutely. And the borrowers are the clients of the broker. So on renewal, we will deal with the broker. We'll keep them in the loop if there's a renewal going out, but typically we'll just send it out to the borrower themselves. But at the end of the term, it's the broker's client. We want nothing to do with trying to place them at an alternate lender or a bank. That's just not for us.
Yeah, I love hearing that, you know, and I think I'm starting to hear that more and more out of lending companies simply because it's number one, the right thing to do. But number two, it's not easy for these brokers to obtain clients, right? They're working day in and day out trying to find people to work with and, you know, to give that client over to a lending company who will then take that client and, you know, renew them for the next 10 years without even letting the broker know, or then takes them once their credit gets better and then flips them over to a B lender. You know, it's if I was a broker, I probably wouldn't want to, you know, work with those types of companies.
Well, I was going to say, I think that given where the market is today, the saturation of liquidity in the market of private money today, and because of the banks not being able to finance a lot of the stuff they used to, right? The private lending space has changed. Therefore, it's attracted more people. I think the attitude before was like lenders would just keep the borrowers because the brokers kind of had that same mentality with the bank. Once they give it to a bank, like a Scotiabank, I'm never going to see that client again. They're going to sell them on line of credits. They're going to sell them on Visa products. I think they had that mentality with private lenders back in the day as well. Now there's so many different opportunities. There's lenders in between privates, in between institutions, in between trust companies. Now they're moving them from one place to another. It would be detrimental to a private lender like Grant to lose those relationships by not including the broker in those discussions and allowing that client to sort of get a better deal down the road with an institution.
You're exactly right on that, Joseph. We want the borrowers to have the best deal they can possibly have because that's what we would want for ourselves if the shoe were on the other foot. So if we're the solution, that's great. We like to be a 1 or a 2 year solution and then they can move on, get back to some better rate financing and get on with their lives, and then we'll take on some new clients, new borrowers, and everybody wins in that situation. Well, the other thing in there too is that we don't want to be running a brokerage. I did that for about 8 years where I had 12 sub-brokers working for me. It was a great experience, but it's a different type of company, and you can't be great at everything, and we're striving for excellence with what we do, and to run a brokerage and a lending operation, you just get scattered in too many directions. So for us, we made the decision, this is what we do, and we want to be great at it. And we try to make tomorrow better than yesterday every day.
What are your turnaround times like if someone, you know, calls you and, you know, wants to get in touch and run a deal by you? Is it something that you can give them an answer on quite quickly? Or is there a lot of due diligence and, you know, they'll hear from you days later? What should people expect?
Well, it depends if I'm on a Zoom meeting with you guys or not.
But, that's true too. Yeah.
Typically, we are a small company, and I do have another underwriter that works with me. And Dave is available for backup if I happen to be away, you know, exploring the backwoods of BC on a long weekend. But what we try to do is answer the phone or get back to somebody that's called in the morning, still that same morning. If somebody calls or emails in the afternoon, respond back within that business day. And I can usually give them a pretty good idea that a deal is either doable or not doable just on the phone. And, you know, obviously it's subject to supporting documents like an appraisal or probably GST for self-employed people. We just want to make sure about a few things. But the thing that's really helped us with our turnaround has been you guys with Mortgage Automator, where we were operating on spreadsheets before, and it would take quite a bit of time to turn around a deal. Now a broker sends in an application through Phylogics. It's in our system. We just check it for accuracy. We fill in a few of the blanks that would be the interest rate and the term and so on, things that we've negotiated with the broker. And literally I can turn around a deal from the time I receive it to sending out a commitment in less than 10 minutes if the application is accurate. And we've done that. I've actually done that on a Friday. A deal comes in at 4:30. I don't think anybody's really expecting it to be looked at, but I had an offer to loan back to the broker within about 10, 15 minutes. And
that's awesome.
they were shocked. Great. And that is due to your software. So Mortgage Automator has sped up our underwriting. Now, from there, we don't know what happens in terms of the client meeting that happens. When does that happen? That next day, supporting documents, appraisers are busy, lawyers are busy, but really sure. The turnaround time to get a commitment letter is quick.
Yeah. And I think that's all the brokers really want, right? Yeah. They want to make sure that someone has seen their deal. They want to make sure they can get in touch with somebody. And it sounds, you know, from what you're saying, more times than not, you know, unless something crazy is going on, they're going to hear from you same day, right? So I think that's all brokers really want. And no, I think that's absolutely great. Now, you've probably underwritten tons of deals over your career as a broker, as a lender. Any fun stories, any interesting deals that you've stuck in your memory? Fraud. I don't know, something crazy.
Yeah, I've got a fun one. So people that know me know that I love to play golf. So that's sort of the background to this story. I had a broker, ironically, she's not in the business anymore, but send the deal in and mentioned the community and said that this property is right next to the golf course. And so I kind of thought, this sounds a little funny because I know that community doesn't have a golf course. So now the spidey senses are jangling, right? There's sure. Something going on here. Something's not sitting right with this deal. So I find the property. It's actually not in the community that was on the application. It's in the next community over, which, true enough, doesn't have a golf course. Neither, actually, the community that in question did have a golf course, but not the one that was on the application. Then it's really not on the golf course, but the property is abut, and there's about a kilometer of dense brush between the property and the actual golf course. So if you're expecting golf course views, you're not getting it. And the other thing that the broker failed to mention, that the property was directly across from the city landfill. So,
okay. Hey, listen, someone else's garbage is someone else's gold, right, Grant?
Yeah, exactly.
Except not in your case.
Just not for us. So needless to say, that deal didn't get done. But, you know, that's the funny thing with all of the resources that not only we have, but the brokers have, whether it be Street View or Google Earth or Purview, there's so much good data out there. There's really no good excuse for an application like that. And I have to say, I think the brokers and lenders are doing a far better job of due diligence prior to sending deals these days.
Now, me and Joe, we also try to play golf once in a while too. I'm just curious, because if you're a scratch golfer, I may have to just end the call right now.
Right.
Like what's your deal with golf? You've been golfing your whole life or something you picked up later on in life?
I started when I was 10. Yeah, I was 10 years old when I started. And by the time that I was, I guess, 17, I was a one handicap.
Oh my gosh. See, Joe is, I think, what are you, Joe? A 20 what?
27.
A 27. Okay. I've shaved mine down to, I think I'm about a 17. But it's impossible. The game is impossible. I don't understand.
Especially when you're playing with Lawrence. It's absolutely impossible.
Personally, I think I'm being set up here right now with this 17 and 27 business, that you guys just want more strokes on the course when we do get out there.
100%.
I'll take the strokes I can get.
It's kind of like anything. Anybody can play golf, but it does take some time and effort to play well. And it's just like brokering. Anybody can be a broker. Anybody can be a lender, but it takes time and effort to be a good one.
So do you golf a lot of rounds throughout the year, or are you not playing as much as you used to?
Not playing as much. I'm usually about 3 days a week, during the height of the season, unless we're out of town. My wife and I enjoy camping and traveling and doing other things. So if there's a weekend that I'm in town, I do want to play. If there's something better to do, I give up the golf for that.
You have a regular foursome?
On Wednesdays we do, and then on the weekends it's just sort of a little bit of an ad hoc group. Whoever kind of speaks up or gets the ball rolling, so to speak, and organizes something. But yeah, generally speaking, we've got a regular Wednesday group, and it's a former banker and a couple leasing guys. So we don't pass a ton of business back and forth, but kind of keep up to date on other industries.
Are there some dollars and cents on the line when you play, or is it more leisurely?
It's a little more leisurely. Wednesday is a competition at our course, but there usually is a beer involved afterwards. I will admit to that. Sometimes
very good.
Two, but that's all I'll admit to.
I try to get Joe to put some coin down. He just doesn't want to do it. He's not interested. So.
And with a 27, you should be making a lot of money on the course.
Joe, you see? I have a question for you, Grant, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, you've been in the financial industry for a very long time. I'm sure you've dealt with some high net worth individuals over your years. What's the best money-related advice that you've ever received? And you know what? It could be from anyone. It could be from a family member.
Your grandfather.
From a client, your grandfather, mm-hmm. anybody. What's the best piece of money-related advice?
Well, I think the best thing that you can do is live within your means. And we've seen people that have very little money live within their means and also go far beyond their means. And I've also seen some extremely wealthy people live far beyond their means or bite off more than they can chew. So I think it's just, you know, knowing what you've got and staying within it, staying within your lane.
I completely agree with you. I think that nowadays people have lost sight of that. Like no one, at least in our generation, right? Sure. Like, I don't know about the older generation.
I would agree.
Everything is, you know, the social media, what can I post?
Very materialistic.
Yeah. Very few people actually save and stay within their means. And I don't know if that's, you know, part of just money being cheap today and everyone wanting to lend money out. Banks, you know, give lines of credits and credit cards and all these sorts of things. Like it's nothing. Like I always say, like, I remember when I was in university, you know, you're 18 years old and they're trying to give 18-year-olds credit cards, right? And mm-hmm. unless you have that education on how everything works, I think it's just a recipe for disaster. And, you know, I'm sure you've seen your fair share of credit bureaus that come through the door where you're like, I don't know how this person lives like this.
You know,
they must be getting calls from creditors all the time. I mean, it must be a very tough way to live.
Well, I think to comment on that quickly, Lawrence, I think the issue with today's generation versus, you know, different generations is people bought a house back in the day for $200,000. And now that house is, worst case, called worth $1 million. And they eventually paid off that house. So they probably never got themselves into a position where they had to continue borrowing and borrowing against that house. A lot of the times now you come down, you buy a house with, back in the day, 5%. Financing, 0% financing. You've got almost no skin in the game. All of a sudden, in 4 years, your house has doubled in value, and you're going, "Hey, I can take some money out, and my payments actually be less than what I'm paying right now for my mortgage because interest rates went down. I'm going to take this. I'm going to buy a Sea-Doo. I'm going to buy a new car. I'm going to go." I remember talking to someone who said, "Yeah, I'm going to pull out money because I deserve a vacation." And I'm like, "So you don't have the money to go on vacation, but you're going to borrow against your house. This vacation is going to cost you 5 times what you're paying for it because of all the interest you're going to pay on it over 30 years. But people, I don't think, care as much today. I think it's a different landscape, specifically with our generation, I'd say, Lawrence. But
yeah,
again, I also think it's more difficult for younger people to attain real estate quicker. I think if you can have one house in your lifetime and then you can eventually pay off, I think it's already considered a success in our generation. So it's a little bit different.
Part of that, I think, stems back to how you're raised at home too, because financial literacy is not taught in schools. And, you know, last time there was a Great Depression, that started in 1929, right? And my parents were born shortly thereafter. And every penny and nickel that came into the house was precious when they were growing up. And that's what they learned. And that's what they instilled to me. Whereas you look at some folks that were maybe born 10 or 15 years later, all they've really known is prosperity for North America or the Western world. Right. And, you know, it's been pretty easy to get a job, savings. You didn't really need to worry about that because the paycheck rolls in or your house goes up in value. I think there's a bit of a generational mindset, and I guess we'll kind of see what goes forward here, what the economy looks like in the near future, and what the children of this recession or depression, whatever it might be, how they manage their affairs.
Right.
So a very fair point. Now, you were saying that you've, in the last 30 days, funded a few deals in this particular area, which means you guys are lending. When COVID came around, did you guys slow down a little bit and now you're back, or were you guys pushing all the way?
Yeah, how
through?
Did you guys deal with COVID?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. The way that our company is set up, a lot of us either work remotely for part of the day or all day. And we were set up by design pre-COVID so that we could work remotely. And so, for instance, I'm in my home office right now. I'm heading to our real office once we're done our meeting. But we have administration that's done out of Calgary. We have investor relations that's done out of Calgary and Victoria. And we have the underwriting that's done out of Kelowna. So when COVID hit and we weren't able to, I guess, we kind of were able to go to the office because our office is fairly spacious and there's not that many people in it. So it wasn't a great risk when the dangers were unknown. But we were able to not miss a beat in terms of our administration, renewals, underwriting. That just kept on ticking along. The new business opportunities dried up for sure. And I remember it was mid-March, I was doing some broker office visits. And basically, that was a Friday. And then Monday, we were all working from home. And the phone was pretty quiet for about, I would say, 2 months, which was fine for us because we were out actually going through our reorganization and merging a couple companies to become Shelter Lending. So yes. when all of the corporate work was done and the licensing issues were all taken care of and properly done, that's when the phone started ringing again, really, I guess, the beginning of June. And we were very busy June and July. I think there was a lot of pent up demand. Mm-hmm. And then August, it seemed everybody was taking a vacation. So it was kind of hit and miss depending on the day. And it seems now September, October, and heading towards November, we seem to be in sort of a more of a regular routine or a regular flow of business.
Interesting.
Fair to say. Now, you were saying you do both first and seconds, mainly seconds is what you really love. Would you rather do like one big second mortgage called $500,000, or would you rather do like, you know, $10,000, $50,000
or 500K mortgages?
Or 500K? Like, you prefer doing the one big one or many small ones?
Our ideal size for our second mortgages really ranges from about $25,000 to $250,000. And so to answer that, I would probably opt for the $10,000-$50,000 deals, even though it's a lot more paperwork, or even the $500,000 deals versus the one really large one. We do have a couple larger loans like that on our books, but they made sense. But it just diversifies the risk. And one of the things that we've made as a promise to our investors is that we're not going to roll the dice on one big file that's going to put their money at risk. Because my money's in there. My parents have money in there. Same with Dave. He has money in there. His mom has money in there. So, you know, we don't want to gamble away somebody's retirement savings.
So you are treating this as it's your own money.
Well, this is own money, right? That's an important thing for investors to know, right? Like if you're going to invest with Grant, his skin is in the game. So he doesn't want a dollar to be lost because he's going to feel it personally and his family as well.
Yeah, that's exactly what my parents told me when they invested. They said, if you lose this, you're losing your own money. I said, no,
right.
we're not losing money here.
Right. And what about like credit? Would you prefer to have, you know, a higher loan to value deal with someone who has like great income and great credit? Or would you prefer like a much lower leverage, a lower LTV deal with someone who has really bad credit, you know, no income, but the equity is there.
And the property backs onto the golf course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's close to the landfill too. So if you're a treasure hunter.
Exactly.
I'm really kind of torn between those two because they both have good features to them. Obviously, somebody with a higher income, net worth, and credit score is going to have an easier time making the payment. And they probably have some other assets to rely on if they do run into a bit of a bad patch. So those are fantastic from a low maintenance point of view on the file management post-funding. On the flip side of that, to have a lower loan-to-value file with a problem borrower is not the end of the world either, so long as the property is decent.
So kind of going into that next question. So talking about problem borrowers, BC and Alberta, from my understanding, have very different ways of handling deals that go into arrears. Have you had deals go into arrears in both provinces? And what were your experiences like in both provinces from actually having to go the full, you know, the full mile? And how long did it take between both provinces to get your money back?
Yeah, the process is slightly different. There's it's probably more nuanced than anything. The timing is roughly similar. We're allowing about a year for the whole foreclosure from the start of a demand letter to actually having a property sold and getting our money back in both provinces. We are actively foreclosing on a couple properties right now. It's not what we want to do. It takes a lot of time, and depending on the circumstances, can be a little bit emotionally draining. Two of the foreclosures were actually brought about by borrower deaths. So it wasn't that they weren't trying to make payments. They just weren't around anymore to make those payments. And in both cases, the estates proved to be difficult to deal with, and we have to protect our investors. So we're going through the motions with that right now, one in BC, one in Alberta. And the time frame is not too much different, but it's just a little bit of timing with notice to the borrower, time to get into court. But really, at the end of the day, it does take about that year. And we've got great lawyers in both provinces that, you know, they know the system, they know what to do, and they're hugely helpful in that process.
What's the issue with the estate? They just don't want to sell the property right away. They're holding on to it, or what seems to be the problem?
Well, in one of the cases, it was actually a younger borrower, and there was no will, so no executor named. So it's taken a while for that process to occur.
That's stuck in probate.
Mm-hmm. And we really don't believe that there's a lot of equity in that property. So nobody's stepping up to maintain the property, to improve it, to make the payments on our mortgage. The fortunate part on that file is because it was a little bit of a weak file to begin with, where the borrower had okay income, kind of poor credit, and it was a bit higher loan to value. We do have a covenantor on that file, and they've certainly got assets and the ability to pay. So we're just working with them right now.
Gotcha.
So you're always happy to do that in a deal. Maybe you don't like the borrower that's on the file. You're happy to bring someone else in, guarantee the loan, and that would make you more comfortable on the file.
For sure. And that was the case here, where we just thought it was a little bit on the edge. They even offered that they had somebody that was willing to co-sign for them. And we said, okay, you know what? They've got reasonable employment, reasonable savings, reasonable equity in their house. And so that was the deciding factor.
Did you tag their house?
No, we didn't in this case.
But now that if you cannot get enough money out of this property for whatever reason, you have the legal right to now take them to, I guess, is it civil court?
Correct, yes.
And then sue them for any losses, and then you'd have a judgment on their property. Again, it's timely, but nobody really wants that on there. So they'll most likely just pulling the remainder of the money and giving you, writing you a check for the difference.
Well, I think that's what's going to happen. In this case, you know, we expect that we may get all of our money, or there may be a small loss, maybe limited to legals and real estate fees. So it's not really a huge amount.
No.
Is it good to be the guarantor in that case? Not really. Is it terrible? Well, it's a problem they can solve with a few dollars and not too many.
Right.
So I don't think it'll impact their future. Right?
Fair enough.
Yeah. You know what? It's like, it's not something that you want to deal with. It's not something that they want to deal with. It's an unforeseen circumstance that came up that no one could have known was going to happen.
Exactly.
But no, it's great that you dotted your I's and you crossed your T's and you made sure that your investors were secure in that position. And good thing you did, because it just shows, hey, listen, something did not go right in this situation, but nonetheless, it's okay because, you know, we made sure that if the worst happened, we had backup to make sure that everyone was secure and safe. So that's,
That's what we're trying to do from the outset. When a broker calls, we're looking for ways to make a deal happen, not ways to kill a deal.
Right.
Because that's how we make our living. And that's how our investors get a great return. So when brokers call, you know, sometimes they're new brokers and they'll even say, hey, I've never done a private deal before, or I do one a year. I say, great, you know what? I do them all day, every day. So just let me know what you've got for details here and let's see what we can do. And if there's a way to do it, hopefully between, you know, myself, Dave, and the broker, we can figure out a way to put a deal on the books, and then it's a win for everybody.
Sounds great to me. Grant, listen, we appreciate you stopping by. To conclude, why don't you just let people know once again what kind of deals you're looking for, where you lend, just so they can start sending in some files to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're licensed in BC and Alberta. We're looking for first and second mortgages. We are technically allowed to go up to 85%, but we're not doing that in the current lending environment. 75 is where we're topping out today. And we like first mortgages upwards of 500,000. We like second mortgages that are between 25,000 and 250,000. And our interest rates go anywhere from 7% and up on a first mortgage, and about 10% and up on second mortgages. Lender fees are usually anywhere from 1 to 2%.
Very reasonable.
On the deal size. And the best way to get a hold of us, you can go to our website to get information on how to contact us. It's shelterlending.ca, or I'm Grant at shelterlending.ca as my email address. And we've got a toll-free number on our website that you can track me down and find me as well.
And as he said, Grant only makes money when he closes deals. You know, when he gets your deal in and he underwrites and he says no, that's not good for anyone. So he's creative. He's trying to find ways to make deals work. Like he said earlier, if your lender's going to 65, he'll probably go to 70. If your lender's going to 70, he's probably going to go to 75. So before you take that deal from your lender that you normally use, give them a shot. You may be able to get your borrower just a little extra money that they need to make them happy. So Grant, once again, listen, we appreciate you stopping by.
Really appreciate your time, Grant.
Always end it by asking you in your specific area, and you are where right now? I know you guys are all
Kelowna,
over.
Kelowna, you right?
You're in Kelowna.
Kelowna, yes.
What's the good pizza place in Kelowna? The one place, if I'm there, I got to go check it out.
Well, we could walk to it from my office. It's called Dunenzi's. And it's pizza by the slice and super thin, super flavorful. You'll love it. And it's my treat when you're in town.
Excellent. I look forward to it. And we got to get a round of golf in. I want to show you that Joe is not lying about his handicap. He's really all the way up there. So thanks again. Thanks for tuning in. Follow Mortgage Automator on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. We are Automator Group on Twitter. Go to askaprivatelender.com to check out all of our podcast episodes. And until next time, thank you very much. And we'll see you again. Grant, thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to the Ask a Private Lender podcast. Go to askaprivatelender.com to check out the other episodes. Follow Mortgage Automator on Instagram, LinkedIn, and Facebook. And we're Automator Group on Twitter. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye.